Welcome to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. In the first part of the hour, our guest is actor and filmmaker Natalie Portman, whose new book, Natalie Portman's Fables, retells three classic fables, The Tortoise and the Hare, The Three Little Pigs, and Country Mouse and City Mouse. Natalie Portman is joined in conversation by actor, director, and entrepreneur Ava Longoria. Then in the second half of the hour, our guests are Evan Bloom and Rachel Levin, co-authors of the new cookbook, Eat Something, a wise son's cookbook for Jews who like food and food lovers who like Jews. Evan Bloom is also the CEO and co-founder of Wise Son's Jewish Delicatessen in San Francisco. And now let's join Heather Moran, CEO of Sixth and I, as she introduces our first guests, Natalie Portman and Ava Longoria.
Now, over the years, Sixth and I has been honored to host a number of Academy and Golden Globe award-winning actors, but tonight's guest is the first guest and only guest to have also attended Jewish Day School in our backyard. Born in Jerusalem, Natalie Portman is an alumna of Charles E. Smith Jewish Day School in Maryland and a graduate of Harvard University. Known for her acclaimed roles in Black Swan, V for Vendetta, the Star Wars prequels, Jackie, and the upcoming Thor, Love and Thunder, she's also a director, a producer, an avid supporter of animal rights and environmental causes, a mother of two, and now a children's book author. After noticing that many of the classic children's books were weighted towards male characters, Natalie became motivated to create a less gender-specific approach to storytelling that was more reflective of the world we live in. With Natalie Portman's Fables, illustrated by artist Jana Mattia, she reimagines three classic tales, offering a modern take on timeless life lessons about hard work, perseverance, hubris, and abundance. These are such important lessons for our children and helpful reminders for us, the young at heart, who read to them. Fables aren't the only way that Natalie is working to level the playing field. Over the summer, it was announced that a women's soccer team and the first women majority owned soccer team would be coming to LA, thanks to the leadership of Natalie and a coalition of female athletes, entrepreneurs, and entertainers, including Eva Longoria, who we are so fortunate to have here with us tonight. Beloved since her starring role in Desperate Housewives, Eva is also a producer. Her production company, Unbelievable Entertainment, produces projects that represent the stories of the Latinx and other underrepresented communities. As an activist, she lends her voice to issues ranging from immigration to reproductive rights. She's a founding member of Time's Up along with Natalie. Thank you. Eva was recently named by People magazine as one of the women changing the world. I want to thank you again for joining us. And now I am so excited to welcome Natalie Portman and Eva Longoria into your homes.
Hello.
Hi, everybody. Oh my gosh. Thank you for that introduction. And thank you, Eva, for having this conversation.
Oh my gosh. Anytime I get to talk y'all to Natalie Portman, I say yes.
The feeling is mutual. Anytime I get to be anywhere near you, I am so happy.
We're so far apart right now, but I am so happy that Heather mentioned Angel City, because that's a big thing that we're doing together. Yes. And a lot of Natalie's efforts went into that. And I'm just excited to be a part of that. I'm really excited, y'all. We're talking about Natalie's new book, Fables. You know what's crazy? It's funny that I'm doing this is because I didn't grow up with books. And you did. But I had four siblings.
Wow. So, you've got storytellers everywhere, I'm sure.
Right. But it wasn't, I don't know. Like, I have a love for them now, but I didn't. And my mom was a teacher, which is ironic. But you grew up with reading. Reading's always been important to you and your family. And you said it helped shape your sense of empathy. because it allowed you to experience a life outside your own. I think when I started reading, that's what it did for me. It transported me to other places. And I was like, this is crazy. There's other ways of life. Talk about that, because was that because you were an only child?
I think a big part of it is certainly being an only child. And I moved a lot too growing up. So I think that, you know, books were my kind of constant companions. You know, I'd be in a new place, I'd be the new kid at school always. And I could always go and read a book and be engaged emotionally in a story. But I also think that storytelling in general, even movies or TV or books, are our way of practicing empathy, because we sit down and we care about someone else's life for a while. I mean, it's funny when you think of it that you'll sit and cry about someone else's pain, who's often a fictional character. You know, you're practicing caring about another human, and hopefully that takes you into the world in a different way. And when you look at someone, you think, oh, I wonder what their day is like, or their life might be very different than mine, because that's what you're starting to instill with the storytelling. And it was so fun seeing everyone's favorite books as a kid. So many of them are also my favorites, you know, Phantom Tollbooth and the Judy Blume books, and you know, so many wonderful recommendations too of things I haven't read. So it's great too, because I don't know if you find this with your baby, but reading to them is like, I don't think I have ever read a book as many times as now. Right. I do reading to my kids, because you end up reading the same book 100 times in a row. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, the favorites just get over and over and over. So there's also something for the parents of like, what are you ingesting as a parent as you're reading to your kids?
Well, it's so funny that you say that, because I have a 2-year-old, and nursery rhymes are really problematic. Like, I was singing Baba Black Sheep the other day, and then I was like, oh my God, what is he saying? And then Little Red Riding Hood, right? Which Abby Wambach just wrote a book about. I mean, not this is her second book, but about, like, I guess the anti-feminist message that a lot of these nursery rhymes have, or like, you're like, no, I'm not Little Red Riding Hood, I'm the wolf. And that was like, that was so eye-opening to me that she thought that. I was like, yeah, I never thought that. And so I thought it was really interesting that you felt the same thing, because I'm feeling it now just with nursery rhymes, and I'm reading books to Santi, but you know, there are ABCs and stuff like that. We haven't really gotten into a beginning, middle, and an end. And
also having a boy and a girl has really highlighted that, because for my son, I don't think I was thinking about it that much. And then when I started reading to my daughter, and I was reading some of the same books, like the kind of classic books to her, I realized all of these are male characters. And then I thought, oh wait, what did I do with my son that he was reading primarily about male characters? And, you know, you want both your kids to, first of all, value everybody's stories, that you don't prioritize male stories over female stories, that a male story deserves to be told more than a female story. Second of all, you want to reflect the world as it is, because you don't want people thinking there's more males than females, which there's not. And then lastly, also just that we see everyone as human, and that we want to empathize with everyone regardless of their gender. And so I just wanted to take the classic tales that were not problematic for me, that still had valuable messages that I thought were really worth continuing to tell, but just make them kind of gender safe, I call it.
Yeah. And also modernizing the language, right? Like the words. I love in the Three Little Pigs, he said, you know, he had new digs. And that was, I was like, oh, that's so cute. Like, it's such a modern word. So you picked these three because you found them least problematic, but also you loved, but you did such a great job of like, these are really good tales. The Tortoise and the Hare is one of my favorite life lessons, right? Mm-hmm. Underestimating your opponent, David and Goliath. There's so many themes in that one alone. But like, why the Three Little Pigs and the Country Mouse and City Mouse?
So the three stories, first of all, I wanted to do stories that were with animals, because I feel like all kids have an equal access point when they're animals. I know when I was little, if I would read a book and there was like a brown haired girl, I'd be, I'm that one, you know, but when it's
me too.
And I feel like when it's animals, you're looking more at the personality to see who you relate to rather than just something that's like a physical appearance. So it gives kind of equal access points to all kids. And then of the animal stories, I wanted ones that I loved the messages and I thought they were like relevant to today. So the tortoise and the hare, I thought there's such a valuable story and like taking your time and being attentive with all the fast paced, crazy noise that's happening. And that there's something like love in really paying attention. And then for the three little pigs, it was, you know, the classic story is that building strong foundations will keep you safe when, you know, a wolf comes. And I thought that there was a kind of environmental turn to that story because, you know, that building strong foundations now is thinking about our planet and how to build cleanly. So, you know, in the old story, one of the little pigs built his house out of straw. And in this one, she built her house out of plastic straws that, you know, are coming out of her takeout and it blows over. So that was the reason for that one. And then Country Mouse and City Mouse, I just think is a relevant story about, forever about, true friendship and, you know, that you don't want people to be around you for superficial reasons. You want true friends because the city mouse obviously kind of gets abandoned when danger comes. And so those three felt like relevant to our time and that could be updated just to reflect the gender dynamics of the world.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. All of these fables could be applied right now in our country, right? Like the
Empathy in general, it's just like, that's all we need is empathy and imagining other people's lives. It's like an active imagination, imagining how someone else's day is and then being sensitive to that.
What was the hardest thing during this process? Like what was was it picking the stories or was it picking an illustrator? Because it's so beautifully illustrated. Oh my gosh, these drawings are so beautiful.
I want to say thank you. I had nothing to do with her incredible talent, except that I was lucky enough to meet Jana and get this gorgeous art sent to me throughout. And it was so fun getting to see her little like jokes. Like I love, there's this one, I'll find, I love this. There's a porcupine making balloon animals. She just put all these little things in that are so cute.
Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. I think it's so beautiful because my son is too young to, like I said, to read like this book, but he enjoys it because it's the illustrations are really catching to him, like visually, which is important, I think, in children's books, right?
Oh, definitely. And it's also why I wanted the table of contents because my daughter loves to choose which story is first, but she can't read yet. So I wanted it to be with pictures because then you can be like, oh, I want that one. And it's so funny. She like really needs to like choose the order and it's always a different one.
Yeah. And, how else did your kids influence this? I read that you read them many drafts. Did they critique you? Did they critique
they
you?
They were my at-home audience. I could definitely sense when they were like interested versus not, what made them laugh. Obviously, they're very different ages. My daughter is 3.5 and my son is 9. So he was picking up more on like, oh, I see how you updated the, you know, the straw to straw. She is obviously on a much like is really for her age. But, you know, they really like anything about poo, farts. So that there is definitely, you know, this part where the bunny makes a stink. That's definitely inspired by them. So, it was really fun to get to have their input and notes.
How do you think, you know, empathy being a major theme, how do you have those conversations with your kids? Like, this would be the jumping off point, right? Like, oh, well, mom, you know, there's a great, another great book about racism for kids, right? And it illustrates like what that means for a child. And so it's, these are just jumping off points. Like, what do you think, or even gender roles, like how do you approach those conversations with your kids after they get a head, you know, a head start on that conversation?
Yeah, it's really hard to know when it's age appropriate to have the real conversations. I think every kid is different and parents need to kind of assess that on an individual basis. Yeah. For the beginning, I don't like talking about things like the big issues with kids. That's why, I mean, I think it's better to just expose them to lots of stories that they should care about and they should relate to of different backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And then also in conversation about what's going on at school in their lives, to always ask, how do you think that makes them feel? What do you imagine that they feel? That's probably the most common question I ask my kids, you know, because that's the kind of thing that comes up all the time. This person did that to that person at school. How do you think that feels? Everyone was saying this about that boy. How do you think he feels when that happens? This girl is always raising her hand in class. How do you think she feels when people say that about her? You know, just to keep asking, because that's the practice. Like, that's the practice, is always imagining everybody's minds, not just male minds, which is what we're conditioned to do.
You know, my oldest sister's special needs. She's mentally disabled, and she has taught me all the greatest lessons about compassion and empathy. Right? Like, if anybody has that point of view, it's her. And she, one day, her jacket was stolen, her Letterman jacket from high school, off of her body, like some bully. And I remember being so mad, and I was like, Lisa, who would? And I was 9, she was like 16, and I was like, who would steal your jacket? And she said, somebody who must have been cold. And I thought, oh, like, you know, like, I was like, that was a very malicious person, but she didn't see, she doesn't still to this day, doesn't see the world that way. She's like, you know, somebody must have really needed a jacket.
Wow. That's beautiful. Those are incredible. How do you envision that with Santi? Like, I mean, he's little still, but.
Yeah, he's little, but no, oh my gosh. I got him the Baby Feminist books. And it's so funny because I remember when I was pregnant and I found out I was having a boy, and I go, oh, I really wanted to raise a feminist. And like me, and I'm aware, and somebody goes, but you will. Like, it doesn't have to be a woman to be a feminist. And as a matter of fact, we need more men in the world that think this way. And I was like, oh my gosh, yes. Like, I thought, oh, my wisdom is going to go to waste on a boy, but no, it's more important. How do your son and daughter interact? I guess is it as far as like, is he a protector, or does he understand like, oh, girls are equal, or is he like, eh?
Oh, he is growing up in such an amazing way. I'm so like moved by him and impressed by him every day, because it really feels like a different kind of male we're bringing into the next generation. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Although I can hardly take credit for it. But one of the things that made us want to do the soccer team for me was seeing my son watch the Women's World Cup, because he was so into it and he loved, you know, he would talk about Alex and Megan Rapinoe in the same breath as he would talk about Lionel Messi and Cristiano Ronaldo and all his male heroes. And it was just, they were interchangeable. And to me, that was a revolution. I was like, is culture change to have boys? I mean, of course, girls, like, of course, girls, we need our heroes. We also deserve to have major athletic careers if we are virtuosic, not me, but if someone is virtuosic, athletic, they should get an amazing career the same way a man does. But what does it change ways to get to look at female athletes as their heroes? female leaders as their heroes in the same way that they look at their male heroes. Because it just makes everybody human, you know, yeah. And you're just looking at people for their qualities and not at their gender. It's sort of like when I was saying about you relate to them, the animals, because it takes away like your human trait that you relate to.
You're listening to actor and filmmaker Natalie Portman, whose new book is Natalie Portman's Fables. She's joined in conversation by actor, director, and entrepreneur Eva Longoria on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
It's so funny because I remember when Caitlyn Jenner came out as Caitlyn, and my friend's son was watching the news and he goes, "Mom, is that a girl or a boy?" Because it was on the TV. And my best friend was like, "Oh God, I'm not ready to have this conversation. Like, he's only six." And he was so confused. And she goes, "Well, he was a boy who felt like a girl. And now she's a girl." And he goes, "So we can choose?" And she's like, "Oh God, this is opening up." And she goes, "Yeah. And she goes, what do you feel like?" And he goes, "I feel like a superhero." Like, he really, that was an option. Like, "Oh, everything's on the table. I'm going to be a rabbit." Like, it's such a good way in. And it was such a sweet conversation because she was like, "Here we go. I'm going to explain, you know, non-binary gender." And he was like, "Oh, no, I want to be a superhero." Okay.
Awesome. She's like, "Yeah, one of my friends asked her daughter, she was pregnant, and she said, "Do you want mommy to have what kind of baby do you want mommy to have?" Meaning like a girl or a boy. And her daughter said, "I want a bad baby." I just think it's so great. Because of course, they're more interested in personality, in talent, and gender shouldn't matter.
Yeah, nor race, right?
I mean,
you see that in children, that who they become best friends with, and that's you know, racism, xenophobia, all of those horrible things are learned.
Oh yeah, you know, and that's why it's hard to read the books to them that are the books that say, even when the message is positive, I feel like it's almost introducing the idea to be like, there is racism, there is sexism, like. You want to do it, but maybe a little later, because when they're little, they don't have that. They don't know that there are obstacles. If you're a girl, they don't know that there are obstacles, you know, and it's nice to, I think, let them have that kind of equal response to everybody when they're little, and just be putting into their environment lots of different stories and not, you know, overweighting it with the kind of overrepresented figure.
Well, it feels like you have five more books to write. Like, it feels like all of them have to be updated and all of them have to be.
Oh my goodness. Modernized. Well, the hard thing with girls, I find, is all these princess stories, which are just like, they love, and you're like, you can't kiss a sleeping girl or woman. Like, you know,
she
like
did
at
not.
The end of every story.
She did not give consent.
Exactly. Like, you're not saving her. You're hurting her.
don't climb up her hair. Yeah. Exactly. I mean, most of them are obviously damsels in distress. And so, or being saved by the White Knight at the end. And so I think that's your next series is turning princesses on their heads.
From your mouth to publisher's ear.
No, you know what book I think you need to write is a vegan cookbook. Have you done that?
I haven't, but I mean, I don't really think of myself as like knowing much about cooking. It's very, you're quite the chef I've been watching.
You know what? I'm on the bread bandwagon, and that's just been a whole COVID journey. I've moved on to croissants, which take 3 days. It's very hard. It's crazy. But I really, we need more options that are kinder to our food supply. And so we're feeling it now, I think, you know, during this COVID pandemic of like farm workers being deemed essential. And I'm like, they've always been essential.
Of course. Of course.
But I appreciate all of your recipes that you post. So wait, now that the book is out, have you read it out loud in front of people already? Or I mean, like, yes. I guess, yes. And how does it feel?
It's great. It's so fun to, I mean, the more I've been doing it, the better I get at it. Because sometimes you're like, oh, that one line is a little harder to say. But it's been so great getting to hear the feedback and getting friends' feedback with, you know, videos of their kids reacting to the pictures of the stories, and yeah, and of course reading to my own kids who, I mean, really more to my daughter. My son can read to himself at this point.
So yes. What was your favorite book growing up? Everybody put theirs. What was yours? Oh, was there any life-changing?
When I was very little, I really liked Mouse Tales by Arnold LaBelle. I loved those. Yeah, like one of, yeah, the mouse's pants fall down. He has to keep them up with chewing gum. when I was older, I was a Babysitter's Club fanatic.
Oh.
Fanatic. Like I had 400 books or something at the end.
Yeah. Crazy. I was Nancy Drew. I was Nancy Drew. And I mean, that was late. Like I said, it was later in life. But I remember going to the library and just being like, wow. What do you think about that? Like the lack of access. There's my son. he's screaming the ABCs right now.
That's so good. That's very early. I feel like he's very advanced.
Oh, no, he knows it in English and Spanish. Sí, mi amor. So what do you think about, you know, how can we get more access to communities that don't have access to books? Because we know early reading leads to college. Like, as early as you can start a child, that puts them on a track to higher education. Like what more could we do?
That's such a good question. I mean, it's not something I know a ton about, but I love libraries. One of the most exciting things about doing this book was I got to go to the librarian convention. I'm like such a fan. I was so excited. And I was like, just asking them for all their recommendations. And it was really, that was really exciting. The library was always my favorite place as a kid too. Mm-hmm. So luckily the library system is intact, but it has definitely changed. It's so interesting how it's kind of changed purpose now too, because it's been one of the last community centers. So it's really important in like homeless services now, in voter registration, in ESL classes, in, there was a whole article about like, I don't know if you saw that, about like dealing with opioid mm-hmm. addiction, that so many people come to libraries when they're in despair. So it's really interesting that books. I mean, I don't know if you read the Susan Orlean library book is like so amazing, but just kind of the changing nature of libraries is super fascinating. Because books really are the center, but it should be like the center of culture, and it kind of is of community now.
So what do you want people to get from this book and just the experience of the retelling of these tales?
Well, I hope that kids and parents reading it to them just enjoy the stories, and that they're fun, and that they have the values we have loved to pass down from generation to generation of hard work, of building strong foundations, of empathy, of taking your time, but that, you know, it just gives a kind of view of the world of the way it actually is, instead of something that is biased.
Yeah. Oh gosh. So many biases.
Yes.
Yes, biases. Is that the word? We're saving democracy right now. And then after that, we will then focus on getting back to work. I mean, let me tell you, this pandemic has really, and it doesn't look like it's coming to an end soon. So I hope everybody's being safe and wearing masks because they do help. But have you rediscovered some books because of the pandemic?
Yeah, you know, I keep going back to Rebecca Solnit. I reread and reread her books. I mean, Hope in the Dark. over and over. I'm reading Whose Story Is It right now. And she has such an incredible way of framing the world, but also it feels very realistic and also hopeful, which is kind of what I need right now. And also just beautiful. Like she's a beautiful writer.
Well, and you can pick it up. It's an easy book to just pick up and open. I am a big nonfiction person. So like, I love Glennon Doyle, Untamed.
I have to read it still. Glennon, our co-owner in the team. Everyone tells me that's like the book that will just.
You like poetry. You read a lot of poetry. It's poetic. The way she speaks and tells her story of her journey and her love story and, you know, all of that. It's just poetic. I mean, you can take every sentence and I want to put it on a shirt. I mean, every sentence in that book.
I love her so much. I mean, I follow her and she's just, she's so inspiring and so active and engaged and loving and like exactly the practice of empathy that we're talking about. She embodies it completely. Yeah.
The other one that it's my second time reading because it's such a great tool is So Now You Want to Talk About Race. It's such a good book. It just opened your eyes in a way that you're like,
I know. It's so crazy how things that can become so obvious that you didn't know before or didn't think about, or, you know, that someone can inform you and shape your thinking in a way that makes you go, oh yeah, of course I knew this, but I didn't know how to articulate it myself. And that's like the joy of a great writer.
Yeah. But you know, so funny, speaking of like just a gender lens as well. I remember one time, like 2008, I think I was at the White House and I was doing a speech and there was this picture of me.
You were at the White House doing a speech. How cool is that?
I don't know. But I was at a podium. Time. And there was a podium and there was the President of the United States emblem, the White House emblem is. And I sent it to my family and my friends and everybody was like, oh my God, you look beautiful. You could be a first lady. Oh my, everybody, by the way, you would be a beautiful first lady. You'd be an amazing first lady. You'd be not one of my dear friends.
You'd be a beautiful, president.
Right. Which is funny. I don't want to be president.
And more than beautiful.
But like, they were like, wow.
Amazing.
But isn't that interesting? Like, it's just like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who says, you know, when will the court be equal when there's 9 women on it? Right.
Right.
We go, nobody said anything when there was 9 men. Okay. I think I'm turning it back over to Heather and y'all, we're going to take questions.
Hey, Natalie. This is a great question. What advice would you give to a new dad raising a woman in our current environment?
This is something interesting about, I think boys and girls are so often taught to imagine male minds that we go through the world thinking much more about male minds than female minds. That's what I think. And so I think for boys, it's always important to point out, how do you think she feels? And for girls, I think it's important to point out, how do you feel? Mm-hmm. Because I think we're taught often to be like, I need them to think I'm pretty and I'm smart and I'm not annoying and I'm polite and I'm sweet. But it's always thinking about how other people are thinking, and I need them to feel comfortable and I need them to feel happy and I need them to feel like they like me. And I think, so for me, to a girl, I think it's always reminding them, how do you feel? Remember how you feel. How does it make you feel if you don't feel happy, if you don't feel comfortable, you say it. That is my kind of unfortunately, I don't think if we were in a bubble that you would have to raise boys and girls differently, but because they are socialized differently by our culture, even if you do your darndest to avoid it, I think that that's sort of the pitfalls of where we can go with our kids.
One of the themes in Fables that comes through so strongly is courage. And I think I certainly feel this about kind of watching you as a woman with a career, that it is also kind of one of your most compelling attributes. So one of the questions that came through the audience is, could you share a little bit about your views and your experience kind of owning your own courage and decision-making in your life?
Thank you for saying that. I mean, I don't feel necessarily particularly courageous, but I do. There's a lot of other people I would definitely describe that way first. But I would say that I think a big influence, actually, you know, you talked about the fact that I went to Charles E. Smith Day School in Rockville, Maryland for a few years while we lived there as a kid. And I went to day school later in Connecticut and New York. And growing up with a Jewish education, I feel like we really were taught so much about prejudice, historical prejudice that Jews have faced, and how important it was to stand up against prejudice, to get, stand up against injustice, to stand, say something when there's something wrong, and that being a bystander is complicity. And that was very central to what I took away from my Jewish education. And so I think that anything that may be termed as courageous simply feels like a product of that, that like when there's something wrong, you need to say it, and you can't, you know, just try. It's, again, you can't just try and be like liked or quiet, or, you know, that you don't have the, you don't have the privilege of that.
That's great. I love it. And I love that it's connected to your Jewish roots. It just, it feels like super authentic and meaningful. Someone is very curious about your favorite movie adaptation of a fable or other classic story. Do you have one?
I don't know of any. I mean, I remember the, I actually didn't see the movie of it, but the musical Into the Woods is such a great way of utilizing all the fairy tales, fables. I think it's more fairy tales, actually, like Little Red Riding Hood, and in this sort of like metaphorical way. That's the one I can think of the most, because some of them I think are a lot of the fairy tales, particularly for I think we just talked about this a little, but they're pretty problematic.
Yeah.
So you have to change them quite dramatically, I think, to almost not be faithful to the originals. To and actually, Rebecca Solnit did a Cinderella Liberator book, great kind of retelling, but it's sort of for older children.
I have two boys, an 18-year-old and 11-year-old. And I have to say that I feel like I didn't do a great job of finding like women empowerment stories to tell them when they were little. And it probably would have occurred to me to do more of that had I had a daughter. And now I'm like, no, Heather, you know better than that.
Well, it's hard. I mean, I wouldn't be hard on yourself about it. I'm sure they're wonderful. And but I think it's really hard. And that's also why I wanted to do classic stories, because I see already that like boys don't want to read the feminist books. Like when it's about feminist heroes or feminist topics or strong girls, powerful girls, it's not the book. I mean, like they won't complain about it if you read it to them, but they're not going to be like, let's read that one, that's my favorite, you know. Right. The way that they might with like something that is just more for all children, like, you know, the Richard Scarry books, or the Dr. Seuss, or the, you know, all those are the ones that all kids read. And that's why I wanted to hit classic stories. I was like, if I do classic stories, then all the kids have the same you know, access and same interest. And that's where you can just be like, okay, there's lots of different kinds of people in the world. They come from all genders, all backgrounds, all races. And that we should care about all their stories.
Natalie, I cannot thank you enough for being here. We're just, we're so excited that you're with us. We're so excited about your book. We can't say enough good things about it. I hope that you feel like all the good vibes. I also want to thank Eva Longoria. Thank you for being here, and just take care, be well, and have a great night.
Yes, thank you.
You've been listening to actor and filmmaker Natalie Portman, whose new book is Natalie Portman's Fables. She was joined by actor, director, and entrepreneur Eva Longoria on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. In the second part of the program, we feature Evan Bloom and Rachel Levin, co-authors of the new cookbook, Eat Something, a Why Sons cookbook for Jews who like food and food lovers who like Jews. Evan Bloom is also CEO and co-founder of Why Sons Jewish Delicatessen in San Francisco. And now let's join Magi Jose Singer of the JCCSF as he introduces our guests.
So the book that we're celebrating is Eat Something Already, that Rachel Levin and our amazing chef, Evan Bloom, put together. So here we are. Like, I'm going to hand it over to our holy brother, Chef Evan Bloom, to sort it all out for us and make some sense of why we're having hash this morning on this beautiful harvest day. Evan. It's yours.
Hey, how's it going, everyone? Thanks to Urban Adama, JCC, Kwesa. We're thrilled to be here digitally. So we're going to make I guess we'll call it a fall hash today, but really, you know, hash is just a mixture. You know, at the deli, we started with a corned beef hash, which I think most people know. Corned beef, peppers, onions, greater than the sum of its parts. Corned beef hash is, you know, the leftovers. It's what do you have that you can chop up and sell or eat? We started doing a vegetable hash when we first opened the restaurant that changes seasonally. It was an opportunity. You know, we've been selling at the Ferry Building for almost 10 years, since actually before the restaurant opened. So it's an opportunity to use awesome produce, do something different and exciting, because honestly, making pastrami sandwiches every day can get a little bit stale. And, you know, there's just so many different things you can do. Rachel, should we talk a little bit about our book?
Yes. Hi. Sure. Yum.
Something that hadn't been done before. I think there's a lot of great encyclopedic Jewish cookbooks out there. There's a lot of wonderful cookbook authors, old and new, where you can get a great recipe for kugel or brisket. And not to say that our recipes aren't awesome.
They are.
The book is about more than the food, as I think, you know, the Jewish eating experiences, you know. When people come into Wise Sons, the food is part of it, but there's nostalgia that people are creating, and there's nostalgia that people are remembering.
Yeah, Evan wanted to do a book that was unlike any other Jewish cookbook out there, and I had never done a cookbook, nor did I really want to necessarily, but this was when Evan approached me and my friend George, who designed and illustrated it, about doing this book. This is the only cookbook I would have wanted to do. And because it's not a traditional cookbook, I think for me, I'm not a cook. I have become one during this quarantine life, more of one than I've ever been. But what appeals to me about the Why Sons and the book was doing a project that's about Jews and food, not just Jewish food, and about the role that food plays in Jewish life and in throughout the generations, and especially today. And from bris to shiva, and all the occasions in between. So, So our book follows that that sort of organization in a fun way. We broke it into, you know, early years, awkward years, young adult years, all grown up, which Evan now is that he has a kid.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, we Jewish people and other cultures as well. I mean, everything is, everything we do is revolves around food or there's food present. So, and it's not just Shabbat or Passover, but all these other occasions that are just as important.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and have just as much, if not more, memory for me growing up.
Yeah, like our brunch section, Evan, when we went through each occasion, it was sort of talking about our own memories, which were shared across, I'm from Boston originally, Evan from LA, but we have these shared memories. And for Evan, the brunch was his image of sitting on his grandma's shag carpet while the family came in with bagels, you know, via golf cart. And I was like, oh, my, same with me, bagels, Tropicana, golf cart, you know, sort of this fun memory of just food being always present and sort of the unifier for every family gathering and friend gathering. So yeah, that's sort of how each occasion sort of is our, hopefully we try to kind of look at our own lives and then hopefully have Jewish Americans relate it to their own and sort of feel that connection as well in both, you know, lighthearted memories and holiday dinners and all that kind of fun stuff.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, you talk a little bit about having this in the book. You talk a little bit about having this like aha moment at your first Passover Seder with Y Sons.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you might, you know, just kind of share that out for folks who haven't read the book yet.
Yeah.
And what happened?
Yeah. So for the Passover section, I dug deep into my archival memory of my own Passovers, my grandparents' house in Brookline, Massachusetts, and I'd always be so bored, and my grandmother's brisket would always be so gray and tough and flavorless, my mom would make me wear these tights that always sagged around my ankles, and I would just be starving, and I just, you know, I didn't appreciate it at the time, whereas now I'd give anything to sit at my grandparents' table in Brookline if they were still here. And so I hated it. I kind of dreaded the holiday and dreaded the only part I liked was finding the afikoman because I got money and it was, and it was fun. But, so then I went to, when Y Sons first, had their early pop-ups, I was a big fan. And then I saw they were having a public theater where people were going to buy tickets and it was going to be held in the cool cafe in the Mission. And there was going to be good wine, no offense to Joe's and his Manischewitz, but you know, there was gonna be good wine and
no offense,
the promise of good food. And I brought George as my date, who was now the designer of the book. And I just sat there and I thought he had Charlton Heston's Ten Commandments playing on the background and his partner Leo Beckerman had these dreadlocks. And he was not my grandfather, he was some young, cool guy leading this service at the table. And it was with strangers, and it was the gefilte fish was delicious. And the whole thing was really fun. And I just thought, oh, wow, like this Passover doesn't have to be this sort of staid, bad brisket of occasion. It can be something.
Passover for me, you know, was always at my grandparents' house. You know, there was 20, 30 people there. And it was always the same food and the same, when do we eat and why are we eating this? Can we go get cheeseburgers afterwards?
Yeah, that was the story.
you know, and in college, I went to Berkeley and, you know, we started to freshman year, you know, my friends and I started doing our own Passover Seder, you know, because we weren't going home for Passover because of the way the calendar fell. So we took it as an opportunity to have a party at the table. We cooked food. We drank way more red wine than we probably should have. I think there's a passage in the book that talks about us having to repaint my apartment because red wine ended up all over the walls. but it was a celebration, and it was that moment where you say, well, these holidays can be more than just, you know, we did all the traditions. You know, and we made brisket and we drank our four cups of wine. But then, you know, yeah. there was room to do things as we wanted. It didn't have to be tired and boring. And around a bunch of octogenarians, which at that time was not something, you know, I really appreciated.
We'd love to just mash it up together now, but so.
I also love how you, in the book, you are both reverent and irreverent to both the people and the food. Irreverent in that, you know, it's like, yeah, we're going to make tacos out of that brisket, right? Or that kind of thing. And reverent in that there's like a real understanding that these foods have taken a role in Jewish continuity, in Jewish identity, in what it means to be Jewish with or without a religious connection, mm-hmm. that the power of something that you actually ingest, right? Something that actually becomes you, that is inextricably linked to a religious or ancient tradition, mm-hmm. right? Even if like the religion, whatever, but you know that there is like particularly something like Passover or Hanukkah that is tied to a mythic or historic event. Mm-hmm. You're on delicate territory when you start messing with that. And on the other hand, what's more Jewish than messing with our sacred stories, right? Like what makes our stories more and more sacred is the more we kind of have at them. So I would love to hear about, like, is there a particular recipe where you feel like you were really like going for it of like taking this thing and like really upholding and flipping it all at the same time? Is there anything in particular you feel like, oh yeah, I know that was the reverent, irreverent culinary moment?
I mean, I like to think about brisket because it's a, you know, it's a great conversation about what is nostalgia, what is, you know, where do these recipes come from? When did we start eating latkes? You know, when did latkes become a symbol of Hanukkah? But when did brisket become this symbol, and why do we remember it with this brown gravy and onions? And, you know, it's a product of our grandparents and our great-grandparents or our parents, you know, and what was trendy and what they were cooking at the time. You know, Lipton's onion soup mix, quick and easy things, Heinz chili sauce, you know, which is a snapshot in time. And so, you know, we took that. Now, we do have that recipe as a footnote. It's, I think, a can of Coke and Lipton's onion soup mix.
And like tomato. Grandma's secret.
Grandma's secret, and it's delicious. But we wanted to evoke that flavor without using any of the shortcuts, so... you know, a lot of onions, good braise, prunes for sweetness. You know, I think, you know, that is a really good, kind of recipe to think about as being old and new at the same time, you know, and then thinking about where you're getting your beef from. You know, that's a whole other topic that we won't go into, but
yeah. And also, yeah, I would say your latkes, like I would say like kimchi latkes or,
With latkes, you know, start with a base, but there's 8 days. So my latkes are very traditional, mm-hmm. you know, and I think you have to make them on a box grater. I really do. But after that, you're like, well, what am I going to do? I'm not going to eat just potato and onion pancakes every day. So you start, what do you have in the fridge? What are, you know, what's culturally important to me? My wife's Korean American. So... you know, kimchi and scallions, and, you know, that they end up going into my latkes by day 3 or 4. Mm-hmm. That's the tradition now in my house. But I, you know, we're trying to create our own traditions while just, you know, I think, Rachel, you said it best, Wisons has its eye. It's like it's rooted in the past.
Yeah, but eye in the future. We take it, what makes it taste better. I mean, what I love too is like when I think I say too in the book, like being from Boston and moving out here, there's not as much of a Jewish community, or I didn't know one when I moved out here. And for me, when I felt like feeling Jewish, I would go to Wisons or I would eat bagels and I would, you know, I feel like it became a Jewish deli became kind of like an unofficial Jewish community center out here for me because the food as Joe so eloquently put it, is sort of where I find my Judaism or my feelings of connected to the culture is through food mostly. And so I think it's important to have these, like, it was so fun to take these, like, sort of these foods that mean so much to our culture from for centuries and remake them into something that is very current and delicious today. And even the matzah. I mean, I thought, that was another revelation at the Passover Seder. I'd never had homemade matzah. So that was delicious. I tried to make it this year. It didn't quite go over as well as it should have, but the recipe is quite easy. But yeah, I think the food, we also have a cheeseburger in our book, which was quite controversial. So.
Speaking of that, there's a couple of things that get raised here that I love that you keep coming back to, which is the folks who did not grow up with these foods, who don't have the baggage or the story of, you know, their Zadie or whatever. These people who are from outside of the Jewish world, who encounter this outrageous, over the top. I mean, Jewish, Ashkenazi, Americanized Jewish food tends to be big and bold, over the top, you know, it's like giant bites, right? Like you don't eat it like this. It's not little, it's big and it's brash, and it kind of holds in that space of that stereotypical, like, loud elbows, get out of my way, put a bunch of it on the plate, right? That sort of thing. And I love there's a little piece in here from one of the chefs at Wise Sons who's non-Jewish, who is in fact a Catholic, a Mexican Catholic. And he says, he talks about, like, encountering these foods for the first times. And he says, for some reason, we get most complaints on Christmas. Someone has to wait for a table or wait for their food. People don't like to wait. What else do they have to do on Christmas? Right? He's like, he sounds Jewish already. Like, what did you do to this guy? And then he says, at the end of the long day, Rodrigo usually brings in tamales. We'll get a turkey and have a staff dinner together. Sometimes I'll make everyone brisket tacos or corned beef rice, fried rice. I'm always adding habaneros, pickled onions, and lime to the chicken soup, to the latkes, to everything. Did you know that matzah tastes great dipped in salsa? Like, this is just like this amazing outreach. And, you know, as America has, like, I mean, people eat bagels all over the country now. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, like, that's an amazing advertisement for, like, hey, if you like our bread, you might like us. And there's a way in which it's like a really powerful counter to anti-Semitism.
I'm going to get that bumper sticker.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
You heard it here first.
Yes, that's good.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Everyone, thanks, Sally.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. Thanks, Joe.
Bye-bye.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. In the first part of the hour, our guest was actor and filmmaker Natalie Portman, whose new book is Natalie Portman's Fables. She was joined by actor, director, and entrepreneur Ava Longoria, and by Sixth and I's Heather Moran. In the second part of the hour, our guests were Evan Bloom and Rachel Levin, co-authors of the new cookbook Eat Something, a Wise Sons cookbook for Jews who like food and food lovers who like Jews. Evan Bloom is also CEO and co-founder of the Wise Sons Jewish Delicatessen in San Francisco. They were joined by Maggi Jo Singer of the JCCSF. I'm David Kwan, editor and producer of the program, and Tina Pamintuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Roshanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kaalw.org. Thanks for listening.